reach the Outrider Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 19 of the Outrider Podcast. I, of course, am Jason Quinn Malott. Before we get to my short intro for today's guest, please let me remind you, go to iTunes or Stitcher and rate and review the podcast. I would greatly appreciate it. That's it. Today's guest is Rachel Weaver. Rachel is the author of the novel Point of Direction. And before I go too much further, let's just go over some of the accolades that Point of Direction has been receiving. So if you haven't picked it up and read it yet, maybe you will. Okay, the big one. It was named to Oprah Magazine's list of 10 titles to pick up now for May of 2014. So pick it up now. It was chosen by the American Booksellers Association as one of the top 10 debuts of 2014. And it was chosen by IndieBound as an Indie Next pick. And, of course, it's one of the top 5 summer reads for Yoga Magazine, which I didn't know they did that, but cool. and, of course, it's gotten a lot of great reviews from a lot of other places, including NPR's All Things Considered. So get out there, pick it up, throw a little money towards Miss Weaver and her book. Let's see. Rachel and I had a great conversation. I hope you guys enjoy it. So let's quit listening to me try to come up with something off the cuff and babble on, and let's just get right to my conversation with Rachel. You know, I didn't meet my first living, you know, working writer until I went off to college.
Right.
Because I grew up in western Kansas.
Right. Yeah, I grew up in Tennessee. Same thing.
Oh, you did?
I knew a lot of farmers.
I hit record, so we're going. Mm. Rachel Weaver. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the living room.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
A little closer to the mic, just in case. Mine's pretty sensitive for some reason. Yours might be a little weaker. I always have problems with the microphones, setting them up.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, the sooner I get it, it just drives me batty. Were you born in Tennessee?
I was. No. Actually, I was born in northern Michigan, and then we moved to Tennessee when I was very young. So okay. I went to school there throughout until high school.
Oh, cool.
All the way through high school.
Now, did you go to college in Colorado, or did you go?
I did. I had sort of a circuitous route, of course. when I was 19, I was a little bit lost. My dad had just died real suddenly, and I had decided to work on the sailboat. So I was doing that in the Caribbean. I'd never actually been on a sailboat before, but
wow.
Ended up on this boat. And while I was there, I decided I would move to Telluride just because I thought it sounded really cool on my own. And I met a woman who was working on the boat as well. And she was like, well, I need a roommate in Boulder. And I thought, well, okay. So that's how I ended up in Boulder. And then I eventually finished school there.
At CU?
At CU, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
What year did you graduate?
94. Yeah.
Okay, so we're about the same age then.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Were you in Colorado, and right after that, is that when you took off for Alaska?
Well, then I did a lot of things. I did an AmeriCorps program on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had to look on the map to figure out which order New Hampshire and Vermont were, because I got this job in New Hampshire. So I went to the East Coast for the first time. I did a year there to pay back some of my student loans mm-hmm. from undergrad. And then I came back. I have an aunt and uncle that live in Boulder, and they became sort of my home base.
Oh, cool.
So I would stay with them on and off and work in Boulder some. And then I worked on another sailboat in the Caribbean. Or sorry, not in the Caribbean, in the Mediterranean for a while. And then I worked up in the Tetons, teaching science at the Teton Science School. And then I came back again and worked at NCAR for a while as a scientist there in Boulder, and then moved to Alaska after that.
So what was your undergrad in?
Biology.
And
science, yeah. Yeah.
Cool. Anything in any particular avenue on it? Something?
Yeah, environmental and population science. So it sort of prepared me to be a field biologist, which right. is what I did for the most part for the University of Wyoming for a while up in the Tetons after I was teaching at the science school and also during. And then I worked for the Forest Service as a field biologist in Alaska.
Wow. So were you always kind of writing on the back end, on the side, secretly mm-hmm. when... And biology was the practical
yes.
education?
Yeah, my mom was a huge reader. She still is. Mm. And a poet. And so I was always exposed to all sorts of writing and always encouraged. Right. But my mom worked as a nurse and my dad was a fisheries biologist. So I was also around a lot of science growing up. And right. I used to go work in the field with my dad. He would take me on his field projects and I would shock the fish over the side of the boat and they would all come to the surface and collect them for various studies and such. So that was my interest in biology. But I was always a big reader. And when I graduated from CU, so I put myself through school, which mm-hmm. meant I had, you know, three jobs. And I took, at right. that time, at CU, you paid for 15 credits, but then any more classes you took after that were free. You didn't pay by the credit hour.
Wow.
Yeah. So I would take, you know, 21 credits or something right. ridiculous and have three jobs. And so my undergraduate experience was pretty stressful. Yeah. So as soon as I finished school, right out of school, I started working for NCAR and I immediately went to Naropa because I was always fascinated and had gone to lots of talks right. and things there, and got their continuing ed, pamphlet and looked up a poetry class and took a poetry class pretty much right out of the gate after graduating from CU when I had time. You know, all right. I had to do was work one job. It was fabulous. and so I started studying poetry with Max Regan, who's an adjunct professor. And
I know Max.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Max has become my guru ever since. So I took poetry classes with Max for probably 5 or 6 years, I think, before I ever started writing prose.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah. So it was always something I was doing on the side of science, I guess.
Now, if you don't mind me asking, you said your father died suddenly. What happened?
He had a heart attack at 45.
45?
Yeah, right. As I'm getting closer to that age, I realize exactly how young it was. I always knew it was young, but
right.
you know, I was 17 at the time, and he still seemed sort of old, but not really.
Wow.
Yeah, it certainly changed the direction of my life, for sure.
Yeah, that would. Now, my dad was 63 when he died, which, you know, not quite as dramatic, but, you know, he's just up and down the last few years of his life. Yeah. He was, you know, a smoker, heart problems, had all this other stuff, and died after a car accident.
Oh, yeah.
Which, you know, for me, you know, he and I always, once I hit puberty, he and I had a hard time getting along.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I think we were on the cusp of starting to reconcile a little bit, despite his sudden switch to fundamentalist Christianity. And then he kicked off. But yeah, cancer, heart attack, water on the brain. He was just crashing hard the last yeah. 5 years. So I was prepared for it, I guess. Nothing quite as shocking as... Mm-hmm. Dying at 45. That's mm-hmm. wow. Has that shown up in your writing at all?
It's interesting that you say that because friends have read my book and noticed things that I didn't even notice.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of absent fathers in my books.
Right.
This one in particular, and then the next one that I'm working on especially. You know, it's not that my dad was absent, but he disappeared quickly out of my life.
Right.
And so I think that comes up in my fiction, just sort of how do you deal with an mm-hmm. absent father? And I haven't made any of my characters' dads, you know, die quickly and early like mine, but it's still that same sort of feeling of the absence of that father figure. It's probably something that I should maybe not have in all my books. It seems to be the thing that keeps showing up. So apparently I need to, you know, think through it a little bit more, or I think it's just in line with my own reality. And right. so it's easy to assign two yeah. characters, you know, with different circumstances, but still that same feeling.
Yeah. You've got to wrestle with what you've got to wrestle with.
Right.
There's
right.
no way around it. Eventually you'll work it out of your system. Don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So you were doing kind of interesting, you were doing stuff in between undergrad and actually ending up at Naropa, where you were associated with Naropa people. So you were bouncing around campus about the time that Laird Hunt and Chris Baer were there.
Yeah, yeah. And then Laird became one of my professors. He was always there in the summer writing program. Yeah, he's fabulous.
Yeah. When I was at Naropa, I ended up taking most of my summer workshops with Chris Baer the year that he was there, and then Alex Pate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just ended up talking to Laird, you know, at panels and discussions and at the seminars, but never really take a class with him. And I wish I had. My friend Laura Hawley did.
Mm-hmm.
And he helped her find an agent. And then she was probably the best writer in our class.
Mm-hmm.
She was the first one that got into the Best New American Voices anthology.
Oh, great.
The one that Joyce Carol Oates edited back in 2003.
Yes. Yeah.
And she was the Capper story on the back end of the anthology. Yeah, so I knew there was something special about her when I saw her, and I thought, I'm going to get to know her because she can't be an enemy. She's too talented.
Yes.
And now she's not writing. She kind of...
What?
One of those things where, you know, she went straight from undergrad to graduate school, so she was 23, 24 when I met her.
Yeah.
And I think just all that pressure and that... and being so good so early, and she just kind of flamed out for a little while.
Yeah.
So every time I talk to her, I'm, you know, are you writing? Are you going to write?
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of my touchstone. If I can keep pace with her,
you
know, I'm doing okay. And now she's not writing, and who the hell? What am I doing? I'm just kind of spinning my wheels.
Uh-huh.
So how long were you in Alaska then?
About 5 years.
Wow. What was that like?
It was good. I worked as a field biologist for the Forest Service. I did a lot of biology work for them, mostly, a lot of raptor work, a lot of songbird work. And then the main thing that was going on when I was there is they were trying to figure out, fishing game in particular, was trying to figure out the population sizes of black and brown bears on all the various uninhabited islands so that they could set appropriate tag limits for hunters, because bear hunting was becoming much more popular.
From helicopters, even.
No, I don't know that they're allowed. No, I don't think on the Tongass they're allowed to shoot from helicopters. But what was happening was a lot of people were coming up from down here, which is everybody calls down south. And so these people were coming up from down south, and they were getting hurt or lost. And so the state was spending all this money to find them. And so they passed a law that said, I don't know a law, but they made it such that if you wanted to go out bear hunting and you were from out of state, you had to go with a bear guide. And so immediately everybody in town became a bear guide. But it actually improved things because, you know, if you lived there, then you had a little bit more sense about where you should be and shouldn't be and how to get around and deal with the backcountry. And so bear hunting was becoming very popular because now that everybody was a bear guide, people were advertising themselves as a bear guide, and so more people were coming up to hunt. And so Fish and Game and the Forest Service were working together to try to figure out how many bears there actually were so that they could set appropriate limits and not decimate the population. So that's a lot of the work that I was doing when I was there.
So you were out in the wilds a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You've gotten around to a few places in the wild stuff, so I'm going to be kind of, I feel like an idiot actually asking these questions because I've kind of have a hard time getting out of, you know, the Midwest and the mountain regions for some reason.
Yeah.
How many people go up there from down here and end up just vanishing into nothing?
Well, I have no idea, but people certainly get into trouble there. I mean, Alaska is an easy landscape to get into trouble with, you know, because you can't hike out to a road like you can down here, or you're not going to run across somebody else who might be able to help you or, you know, give you some water or whatever you need. Actually, there's plenty of water there, but it's just a place that's easy to get into trouble.
Right.
And so, yeah, so I don't really know how many people do or don't. I do know that one of the popular mountains to climb actually was in that book, Into the Wild. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm. I never read that one.
Okay, so it's about this kid, Chris McCandless, who goes and ends up in the bus, like somewhere...
Right.
Somewhere in the interior, like around Anchorage or something, or Fairbanks maybe. But the guy who wrote it, whose name is escaping me right now, he talks about climbing this peak outside of Petersburg, and it mm-hmm. was a peak that a lot of people climbed, and you have to go across a glacier to get up to the peak, whatever. Well, there was one helicopter pilot in Petersburg, and that was the access over there. It was called Devil's Thumb, is the name of the place. And so these people would show up every year and want to climb Devil's Thumb. They're, you know, accomplished mountain climbers from all over. And Wally, my friend who was the pilot who flew me around for the Forest Service and all the rest of us at the Forest Service, he was the one who would fly them there. And after, you know, 3 or 4 years of this and people, you know, they would not come back. They wouldn't be at the point where he was to pick them up. And then it would be his job to fly the search and rescue crews around and
right.
pick up these people who had perished. He just put a moratorium on it and said, I'm not flying anybody else out there. I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care that you came from New Zealand to climb this peak, whatever. I'm not flying you there because I don't want to go back and look for you. So it was certainly a part of what was going on up yeah. there.
What was the riskiest situation you found yourself in?
I did get left out one night, overnight. So usually what would happen is I would get dropped off for the day. Sometimes we would camp or stay in field camps, but a lot of times we would just get dropped off by float plane for the day on these uninhabited, for the most part, islands. And we would do our work, and then the float plane would come back and pick us up at a designated spot at a designated time. And so it was a particularly cold day. Most of the summer, I wore a winter hat all year round in Alaska. It's pretty cold on the coast.
Right.
And it's like 40 degrees and raining pretty much all
summer. I got that impression.
Yeah, it's cold. So, you know, I always packed extra clothes. And so on this particular day, I'd gone through my 3 sets of clothes. I was soaked in my third ones.
Right.
Slightly hypothermic, which happened all the time as well. And, the clouds, you know, came in, it was just off the water. We heard the plane above us. We're on myself and my field partner were on the beach where we're supposed to get picked up. And we heard the plane above the clouds and we heard him turn around.
Oh.
And then they came over on the radio. The dispatcher came over on the radio and said, he can't land. It's too socked in.
Right.
You know, it's been raining for weeks at that point. It was late August. There were bears everywhere. We didn't have a tent. We didn't have any, like, nothing to spend the night. There's no way we're going to be able to build a fire. But I had heard of a homesteader who lived on the island. And the reason I had heard about him is because he had chased a Forest Service plane out of the bay with a 12-gauge shotgun. And so I called that guy on the Marine radio. I switched our Forest Service radios, could act as Marine radios as well. So I got a hold of him on the Marine radio and said, you know, we're stuck on the beach. I think we're in the bay that you live in. And sure enough, he came over and picked us up, and it was an interesting evening. It took about the better part of... close to 2 days before they were able to come pick us up. So we spent this time with this homesteader. It was very nice, very nice. But, you know, folks that had never, you know, had left society a long, long time ago.
Right.
And it was a little odd. A little odd. At one point, he was digging this long ditch.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we were just sitting inside and... You know, and I kept asking if I could do something to help because they were just sitting around, you know, and they live off the land. They're really,
right.
like, they're working all the time, you know. And so I went outside and I said, can I help you? And he said, you don't want to help me. I'm digging your grave. Oh, really? And then he went.
Was that about the time you decided to go back to Colorado?
Yeah, he was just kidding. But it was an interesting day and a half.
I'm sure there's got to be a lot of characters up there. A
lot of characters. Yeah, good place to gather characters for books.
I bet. Good grief. So what was it really that finally ended up bringing you back?
Graduate school.
Just got tired of counting bears?
No, I sort of worked my way out of a job at the Forest Service. Mm-hmm. It was a very small place that I lived in, so I needed to either move to a bigger city, my choices were sort of Juneau or Anchorage, and so then I really started thinking, well, do I really want to continue as a biologist? And at that point, I'd had each winter off,
right?
And I had been writing, and I had started this book, started another book, had outlined a third book. I was just really, really, I had all this time, and it was dark all the time, and so I was really starting to write a lot and take it more seriously, and actually talk to Max. And at that point, he was leading. NARUPA eventually established a program in like a semester abroad in Prague.
Right.
And so this was in the early stages, and he said, I have a scholarship, which I don't think he really had, but he offered me this scholarship, which basically meant that I could sleep on the floor in his room and,
In Prague,
yeah, and participate in this writing program that he was running at the time. And so I accepted the scholarship. And in that time there, I really realized that's what I wanted to pursue.
Right.
More so than biology, although I always thought I would go back to it. I thought that I would just take time off. You know, I was kind of at a point in my career where my biology career where I needed to go to grad school anyway for that. So I kind of thought, well, I'll go to school in writing first and then school in biology next. And, you know, spend these 2 years really focusing on writing and see what happens. And of course that got me way off track of biology. So, yeah.
So I guess you then, with your mother being a poet, you had a lot of encouragement growing up with writing.
Yeah, certainly. She wasn't writing a ton when we were young. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was growing up, she was mostly working. But since she's retired, that is what she does.
And she's publishing?
She is publishing locally.
Excellent.
And yeah, she's doing great. She's doing great, yeah.
So we can direct people to track down and read your mom too, right?
And possibly, yeah.
Okay.
She's getting started. She's doing good.
Cool. Yeah. Who then, with that influence and everything, who then were your guys? One of the things that I've always been very interested in is that as writers, we kind of get to choose our lineage, mm-hmm. which line of writers we want to emulate. Who are our go-to guys, the inspirations? So where do you kind of fit yourself in?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. And it's been interesting to see how my book has been where it's been placed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been called a romance. It's been called a thriller. It's been called an adventure novel.
Right.
It's just like a psychological thriller, which I think is kind of a stretch. and so it's interesting, you know. And also the other thing is, I had a super hard time getting finding an agent first of all, and then she had a hard time selling it. And most of the feedback I was getting was, oh, it's a quiet book, which is the opposite of a psychological thriller, which is hilarious to me. So I think people can't really decide, you know, what it is. And but as far as how I would determine my lineage, I would say that sort of the Edward Abbey, Terry Tempest Williams, Rick Bass, just those real place-based lyrical writers. Not that Ed Abbey is all that lyrical, but he's more adventure based. Terry Tempest Williams is certainly place based and lyrical. So if I had to ask to be let into some lineage, that's probably the one I would ask to be let into.
I ended up at NARUPA because I wanted to attach myself to the Beats.
Yeah.
I think just because having been stuck in one place for so long, the idea of wandering and of travel appealed to me, although I'm not that great of a traveler.
Mm-hmm.
I think I value routine just a little too much, and people mm-hmm. like And it always frustrated me when people would say, oh, you should travel if you want to be a writer. You need to travel. It's like, mm-hmm. do I really?
Yeah.
I mean, if you pay attention, if you open yourself up to what's around you, yes. the world will walk by you.
I agree.
Eventually.
Yes.
Be patient. You don't.
Yeah. I agree.
So, you know, that, but I love the idea. That's just kind of what Ann Waldman always said, that kind of outrider tradition is sitting out there and taking a look at what's going on in the mainstream. You're not really apart from it, but you're not, you know, enmeshed in it in that way that you can't see what's going on.
Right.
You know, and I had to get away from the modernists.
Uh-huh.
You know, right. The Hemingway picture back there that stares at me just kind of all the time.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm running from. I worked on the first novel. I was trying, you know, to be like Ondaatje. It was mm-hmm. my kind of my touchstone for it. It popped out there, and they compared it to they said it was an update to Hemingway.
Uh-huh.
I was like banging my head on the table. So.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, it's funny what happens to your book once it goes out in the world.
But it's a lot of fun, though. I mean, yeah. that's kind of why you do it, is to let other people run off with it and mm-hmm. take control.
Mm-hmm.
If you're so interested in just controlling that book, you didn't have to publish it.
Right, right.
So when you came back to Naropa, what year did you start there?
2006.
Yeah, I left Boulder in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up getting fired for insubordination from
my
job. Oh, yeah. That's always fun if you can manage that sometime. Because I decided even at 30-something, I'd rather live in my mother's basement than be homeless in Boulder.
Uh-huh.
So who... Okay, was Laird teaching there for a while when you got back? I mean, mm-hmm. just the summer programs?
He was there just in the summers, yeah.
And was Bobby still?
Bobby was there. She had a big influence on my book, actually.
Yeah.
She said in her Bobby way at one point, you can't have just two characters in a book. She said, you're going to need a ghost.
Right.
And so she was the impetus behind the previous caretaker at the lighthouse.
Oh, right. That's an important part of the book.
Yeah, I thought, well, I don't really want a ghost, but I can have a ghost character.
Right.
You know, someone who's not really in the book, but is, but isn't.
Pretty much everybody I know has a Bobby story.
Mm-hmm.
What's your Bobby story?
That's probably the one. The other thing is, this isn't a great one, but I think of her all the time. She would teach, in the summer, she would teach this, you know, half-hour thing about basically how not to make, it was called something hilarious, like, how not to make a fool of yourself when you read, or something. Yeah.
I know why she started that class. I'll tell you that story in a minute.
Yeah. So she had all these, you know, things that you should do, and, you know, it was like, never take your clothes off. There's all these things, but then, like, the more practical things, you know, like, don't use staples because then you, like, make a big ruffle with your paper
right.
when you turn it. She's like, never throw your pages because that's just stupid. it's just really very Bobby-esque. But I do think of her with the staple thing. And she also made the point of, you know, like, end your page at a point where you would naturally breathe so that then you can turn the page
right.
or, you know, put it behind your other pages at a point that makes sense rather than that, like, awkward
right.
stall out thing mm-hmm. that happens. But yeah, I guess that's probably my Bobby story. But.
Oh, she was my advisor. So she, everything I turned in for the summer writing program and the thesis all mm-hmm. went through her. And I took a lot of classes with her. You know, I just loved her, just regal and imperious, just there. And one of the student readings, at the end of the semester, I had signed up to read, and I was tacked on at the back of the thing. And the first part before intermission was, to put it politely, a travesty.
Mm-hmm.
I had this friend of mine, Evan Hundhausen, who on the side likes to DJ. He still lives mm-hmm. in Boulder, I think, goes by DJ Cola.
Okay.
And they had tapped him to, you know, spin some tunes before an intermission and stuff like that. So he was actually sitting on the stage behind the readers. Mm-hmm. And at one point, this guy gets up and he's doing his poem and he's playing the piano with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and all I remember from him was, you know, at one point he messed up and he just kind of turned to the audience and had this kind of like, you know, cheesy Liberace grin on his face. Mm-hmm. And then went back to doing whatever. Mm-hmm. Somebody else sang, you know. one woman, this was the moment of crisis, mm-hmm. got up and she was in a costume. She had on this, you know, choir boy, you know, acolyte type of thing from a church, whatever. And as she's reciting her poem, she's pulling off pieces of this clothing, uh-huh. to the point where she's standing there in this leotard that has this like lion or leopard or something printed across it. Mm-hmm. And the poem was one of the refrains of the poem was from an old spiritual. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Right. And she just keeps repeating this and getting louder and louder. And, you know, she's this bone thin, scrawny, older woman, you mm-hmm. know. And so she's standing there in this print leotard thing at one point screaming, were you there? And I'm sitting in the audience next to my friend Laura, and she's turning red, trying not to laugh, you know, biting her tongue, hand over her face. And I'm mm-hmm. about to die up there, not just because of that, but because Evan, who's trapped on stage, mm-hmm. has just gone completely zen. He's just kind of leaned back, closed his eyes. I don't know where he went, but he kept a straight face through the whole thing. And I'm mm-hmm. dying in the back row. And so intermission comes, and I walk out there. Laura and I are standing there going, oh, my God. And Bobby comes up to me, you know, that, like, she's got something to say. Mm-hmm. And she stops, and she looks at me, and she goes, are you going to sing? And I said, no. She goes, are you going to play the piano? I said, no. She goes, are you going to emote? And I said, no. And she goes, good. Turned on her heel and walked off.
Yeah.
And yeah, the next day, you know, walk into class. And Bobby's like, oh, there you are. The one bright spot in the reading last night. And I was like, mm-hmm. cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's full of wisdom.
Oh, yeah. I love directing people that have never heard about her to find her books, to read her stuff. She's yes. fabulous.
She is, yes. Yeah.
I miss her a lot. Of course, I don't know that she would remember me.
Yeah.
She's still yeah. having memory problems mm-hmm. a little.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh. But yeah, you can't beat Bobby. Mm-hmm. Was Reed still active? Reed By?
Yes.
A lot?
Yes.
Yep. It was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. So who showed up during the summer writing program? I mean, that you particularly attached to?
Probably Laird. I took yeah. his class every year. And Max was there in the mm-hmm. summer, so I'd always take those classes as well. Who else? There's one more woman whose name is not coming back to me. But yeah, I would say probably Laird. He's the professor that I have stayed the most in touch yeah. with, along with Keith Abbott. Although mm-hmm. Keith wasn't there in the summer, he was there in the regular year. but yeah, those two.
I miss it. Yeah. I miss having that kind of a community of writers. But you're still mm-hmm. in Colorado. You're just mm-hmm. down the street in Louisville, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So you get...
It's interesting, though, because most of the folks from schools, you know, left.
Scatter, right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I have a writing group that I work with now, although most of them are... It's interesting because most of them are professional magazine writers, mm-hmm. Writing memoir and some fiction, but none from Naropa. I am on faculty at Lighthouse Writers Workshop, which is
oh, cool.
down in Denver, which is where I am just starting to establish a bit more of a writing community. They have some right. amazing folks that come in, you know, that are associated with them. Although, you know, I come in at 6 at night to teach a 2-hour class and, so I've been a little it's been a little bit hard to keep that sense of community that we all had in graduate school, yeah. You know, as everybody goes back to work and, you know, does all their normal yeah. stuff.
I think it also depends upon the community if, in general. And mm-hmm. Boulder always struck me as being a little bit more arts friendly.
Yeah.
Then you've got, you know, the stuff down in Denver and that type of stuff. You've got all the other programs that are floating around up there, you know, and got the CU program, you've got the Colorado State program, Denver's Metro has some interesting mm-hmm. stuff going on. So there's always something you can kind of mm-hmm. hook into, mm-hmm. Which is what's driving me crazy in the, what I think 10 years that I've been back here in yeah. Wichita
yeah.
is the MFA program here is one of the more well-respected ones in the country, but they don't have an outreach program, which is curious to mm-hmm. me. And I think one of the reasons I was always told they didn't have it was because if they started doing something for free, they'd be expected to always do it for free,
mm-hmm.
Which goes against, for me, the kind of the lineage that I wanted to hook into, which is you get out in the community and you engage with it.
Right, right.
Of course, I came back here and I also for a while had that kind of snooty attitude, you know, mm-hmm. When I was... Mm-hmm. Colorado. Yeah. mm-hmm. Very practiced at that. I had to give that up. Mm-hmm. But there's not much of a community around here. I'm trying to finally, after 8 years of wanting to get out of here, realizing that I'm kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Better make the best of it.
Right.
But yeah, there's a few decent writers around here.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get them all together in the same room is a challenge.
Uh-huh.
But how important has, I mean, have you, do you stay in touch with people from your class from that, those couple of years?
I was an unusual student in that I had borrowed money to go to school for undergrad. And so I had just finished paying off those loans. And so I was bound and determined not to borrow money to go to graduate school.
Right.
So I worked and took classes, you know, one or two at a time. So I worked full time through graduate school.
Okay.
So I was actually at Naropa for 4.5 years.
Wow.
Yeah, which was good in some ways. And then also kind of kept me out. Like I was never a part of the group of people that mm-hmm. were just going to school. You know, like I was
right.
so busy because I was working and trying to take one or two classes. And so I actually saw lots of folks graduate in the time that I was there.
Right.
But yeah, I do keep in touch with a few. It's fun to watch who's, you know, who's still working mm-hmm. at it. And like you said, it surprised me how many people just stopped writing after school. It's really interesting how that happens.
Disappointing when they were really good.
It is, yeah. But it's hard, you know, once you are starting to balance more things than mm-hmm. just school, I think it's a lot harder to keep that commitment, you know,
right.
going.
So what's kind of kept you going? What's the thing? Do you have a discipline?
I think it's the science side of me. I'm very goal-oriented. And so if I set out to write a novel, I'm going to write a novel.
Right.
I also just love it. I can't mm-hmm. really imagine not doing it. I wish that I had more time.
Oh yeah.
I used to spend so much time writing and now life is busier. I have 3-year-old twins. So that
wow.
keeps me,
yeah,
that's changed a lot of things. but yeah, I can't really imagine not doing it. And also, you know, I've invested so much time at this point and money in school
right.
And I feel like it's a light. I can't remember who said that. It might've been Laird. Somebody in school said, you know, this is a lifelong commitment, you know? And
right.
so, I guess I just view it as that, you know, this is my first book. I'm hoping to have learned a lot from it. I feel like I have, and hopefully
right.
that will be reflected in my next book. And, you know, I hope that it will just continue. I'll just continue on that path, wherever that path leads, you know, hopefully it leads to a better book and a better book. And, you know,
yeah. so. Yeah. And Mark Maron always talks about how he's gotten to a point in his life as a comedian that mm-hmm. it doesn't make any sense to try and do anything else because he's not qualified to do anything else.
Right.
And I've kind of reached a point, you know, for myself where, what else am I going to do?
Right.
I guess I could, you know, continue to disappear into corporate America and edit other people's stuff for the rest of my life. But I think
I edit a lot of other people's stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it wouldn't be so bad if I were editing fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be bad. let's not try and rationalize that away. It'd be bad, but it wouldn't be as bad. Right now, I'm making sure that engineers speak English to people that just graduated high school. You know,
yeah. I mean, I work with engineers as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're an interesting lot of people. Their social skills are worse than ours.
They can be, yes.
So how long did it take you from the time, when did you, how long was that stretch of finding an agent? You did find an agent, right?
I did, actually. This is, Point of Direction is the third book I've written.
Mm-hmm.
I should say it's the first one I've ever finished, now right. that I understand what it takes to finish a book. But I had a previous book, which I have gone back to now. That's the one that will hopefully be my second book. But that one was agented. Mm-hmm. And that one didn't take long at all to find an agent. That took, I don't remember, maybe 6 weeks. But I remember that I had queried 75 agents for that book.
Just all big shotgun blast all at once?
Yep.
Wow.
And this agent.
How did you find that many agents that you were willing to submit to?
Yeah, so I have this huge spreadsheet that I still work off of. Again, this is the scientist side of me, right?
Right.
Where that was a while ago. That was when I was first at Naropa. So back then, most didn't take email email query submissions. And there weren't as many websites that listed agents.
Right.
So I used the Writer's Market and just made a long list of, I went through every page of that thing in the agent section and made a long list of every agent that took literary fiction.
Right.
And then queried every single one of them. I also went to the bookstore, went to the Boulder bookstore, and I looked through, I had made three general categories for my book, you know, like a strong female character and place-based novel and something else. And I went through and just walked along the shelves and I wrote down every single book that fit into those categories as well.
Wow.
And then looked in their
right.
acknowledgments to see who their agent was. And so then I would write to that agent and say, you know, my book is similar to this other book that you represented in that, you know, I've got this strong female protagonist or it's a place-based novel or
right.
whatever. But that novel and that agent, she did a great job. She sent it. I think she had 45 agents, mm-hmm. or sorry, editors at all the major publishing houses in New York City reading it. And every single one of them passed because it was a quiet book, which I now realize was a lack of plotting. I think
right.
it took me a long time to learn how to effectively plot. And I don't think I learned that until my agent now, Susan Raymer, got a hold of Point of Direction, put me through what was essentially a 2-year postdoc after my
right, right.
graduate degree in how you plot a novel effectively, which was brutal. but right. She was absolutely yeah. right. She taught me what I needed to learn, and I will be eternally grateful to her.
Growing up, had you not read a lot of plot-based fiction?
That's the problem. I have read so many books. I don't know why it didn't sink in. I think because I was so much more interested in the language of books and mm-hmm. in the lyricism and metaphor and, you know, all the vague
right.
parts of books. And I had that down early. But I think Naropa really helped me with that
mm-hmm.
side of things. It definitely encouraged that. But those like hard facts of, you know, A leads to B leads to C
right,
leads
right.
to D. I just wasn't doing that well enough to pull it off. So, and that was just my process. You know, I work with a lot. I run a editing business now, and where I work with novelists to help them get their books ready to go, either to, you know, send out or to self-publish. And it just seems like everybody has something that they have to learn that, you know, generally comes quickly and easily to other people, but not to them. And that, for me, that was the thing that it took me a long time to learn.
It's one of the most common problems that I've come across when I've talked to other writers is they always have had a problem with plotting, and which I'm interested in, because to me, what my weakness always has been is from my perspective is depth. Plot, I got cold.
Yeah, see,
you
lucky.
Know, I try to figure out where it came from, and I think it probably came from comic books. And being, when I was, you know, really young, more interested in TV than books. Of course, I always had books around the house. I was always read to, you know, there was always that opportunity to read, but I was a boy. And it wasn't until I got to a junior high and high school, and realized that I wasn't going to be, you know, the starting quarterback for the Dallas Cowboys. That
hard realization.
Oh, that was tough to deal with, you know, that not being, and realizing I was never going to be a fighter pilot because I was blind and not any good at math. Yeah, I picked up a book because I needed something to escape, and that was kind of, you know, so on that, that was the little key that unlocked it. You know, I don't know how many of those Scholastic readers when I was a kid, my parents bought books for, and they go, "Why don't you read them?" You know, and they're on the shelf. You know, I use them to prop up other things. So I felt like I've always been kind of behind on putting, you know, substance and detail and sense and everything like that into stories. And my thing was always just being able to, I can roll out a plot easy. So it's just interesting. Everybody's little particular weakness. I am, you know, and then they make a big deal about point of view and focalization. And I know people that struggle with that and yet turn it somehow into a weakness with the way that they are able to master other parts of it.
Right.
Alex Pate, I love his work, but he's got this weird handle on point of view. Where he just can switch at the drop of a hat. And you, like, I get it. I understand, right. And you go with it because everything else in it is so strong. And then I had people, you know, other classmates that would try to do that same thing, but the other elements of the story were not strong enough to get the reader to trust that move. And that's a tough, tricky move.
That's a hard one.
I don't even want to play around with that one. So you had written most of this one before
Point
of Direction started?
I had started this one, and then I took one of Bobby's classes in which we had to write 100 pages. And so that was really where I had written most of 100 pages, but I went back through and really started focusing on it again. Because by that point I had been sending out my first novel. So then I was ready to focus on the next one. And then I got kind of sidetracked cause I got stuck with this one. I just couldn't figure out. It was actually kind of a hard plot because of what Bobby said, because there were only two characters and I've got them on this, you know, isolated island where nothing happens. And so it was a hard thing to figure out, you know, like what should happen and what does happen. And there's been so many different things that have happened in the book before I finally, you know, decided on what happened. So I set this one aside and I wrote a third one, with many more characters and more situations that was much easier to handle. And then came back to this one because I always really was caught by this idea of who would go to such a, who would make the decision to go to such a remote place and what would happen there. And
you added two ghosts to this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
we don't want to spoil it for the people that haven't read it.
But. Well, I thought, well, you got one ghost, you might as well have two.
Two.
Yeah. Everything I just needed more characters. You know, I really needed more. There needed to be more. It's very hard to write a book about two people and not have it become redundant and kind of annoying.
Yeah. You can do it. You just you need to get them off of an island.
You do, yes.
So how long then did it take you to find the agent for this one, the second one?
So for this one, well, let's see. By the time this one came around and I was ready to submit, everybody took email queries. So, mm-hmm. I wrote the form query. I already had the list of agents that took literary fiction. I added to it because by then there was more resources,
right.
Online resources, as well as Jeff Herman's guide, which is a really good guide for folks looking for agents, because he interviews agents and the main thing he does is ask them what they like to read,
right?
Which is fascinating because you can look at a list of what someone likes to read and know immediately if they're going to like your book or not. So it was really helpful. So I added to my list and then I queried 150 agents in a period of about 2 weeks, which I thought was so efficient and I was very proud of myself. But then what happened was I started getting, 5 to 10 rejections a day.
Right, right.
Which was brutal.
Oh, yeah.
Totally brutal. And then I had, to offset that a little, I had definitely had people asking for partials and the full manuscript. I had two agents that were asking for revisions, but had not offered representation. And then I want to say, 7 or 8 months into the whole process, Susan Raymer, who represented the book The Help, mm-hmm. Called and asked for the full manuscript. And I sent it to her and she called back and said, I want to represent this book, but only if you're willing to do some major revisions. And so I thought, well, yeah, of course, but at the time I was 7 months pregnant with twins and on bed rest.
So you had time.
Yeah, I thought, well, for sure. I no problem. Do all kinds of revisions. And I went through 2 revisions. Of course, then the babies came. It was mass chaos at our house. Right. I think it was around the 6 or 8 month mark of working with Susan where she said, I got this terrible email from her in which she was very kind and very nice the way she is. And she just said, I just don't think you're going to pull it off with this book. It's just, you're making these, surface changes. You're really not getting at the meat of mm-hmm. what's wrong with this book. And I just don't think you're going to be able to do it with this book. And she said, why don't you just call me when you're done with your next one? And, so I felt sorry for myself for a pretty solid 2 weeks. And then I wrote back to her and said, can I, because at this point she'd been working for free, right? Cause she doesn't get paid till she sells it. And it had been a long time. She'd read lots of revisions and we'd had lots of discussions and, I was basically a charity case at this point. And so I said, can I have one more shot and 8 months? And she said, okay, sure. Call me in 8 months. And so, my husband is not a writer, but he's very creative and he is his most creative after 3 beers. And so we went out, we got a babysitter, we went out and, one of Susan's main criticisms was that the subplot was not supporting the main plot well enough.
Right.
And so I invited my husband into my creative process in a way that I never had before. And he was so excited. I basically just said, okay, here's the problem. Complicate it. Like, here's the main plot, the subplot. He had read the book, but I had made a couple changes. So I explained the changes and I just said, can you complicate this? Like, what would you do? And he was like, okay. And he got so excited. He was like, what if, and he went on and I just ended up with my head on the bar because it was just like that. Oh, he had said one thing that he had came up with a whole lot of ideas that were slightly ridiculous, but he said one thing that I thought, that's it. That's what I have to do. And that is going to mean a full rewrite, like starting from page one to integrate that change. And I did integrate that change. And that, of course, was the thing when I sent it to Susan 8 months later. And she was like, you fixed it. You totally fixed it with this.
Right.
Thing. I can't say what it is because it will spoil.
No, we don't want to spoil it.
Yes, but
it's too good.
But yeah, and so then I had to admit that it actually wasn't my idea; that it was my husband's idea. And I asked her if I had to put his name on the front cover of the book with mine. She said, "Well, maybe not." No. But it certainly was his idea. And then I, you know, tweaked it and made it all fit. But I think I just got so lost. You know how you do when you're writing; you just get so lost in the book. You can't see it from outside, and I think I just needed him to just
you get
be like
way too familiar with
He just like disrupted the whole thing,
right.
And in that disruption it all came together. So
cool.
Yeah, so the whole process, I guess, from the time I started looking for an agent until I signed with Susan was probably 8 or 9 months, and then it was about a year and a half or 2 years of rewriting, maybe a year and a half of rewriting for her. And then it took her full year to sell it. It got tied up at Riverhead Books for a long time, and they eventually passed. And then
It looks like you got a small, good press here.
Fabulous. Yeah. I cannot say enough good things about
it. I love small presses.
Yeah, it's been such a great experience. You know, I didn't know anything about them before. I've had a couple
friends. They're
relatively
new from what I hear. So.
Yeah, I think they've been around for about 10 years, but they only publish, they publish very few. I want to say they only publish one book of literary fiction each go around. I don't know what that's called. You know, each time they publish a group of books, so there's only one literary fiction. They do a lot of political books. They have a series of YA books. But I think because they have so few literary fiction books at a time, they, I feel like I've gotten so much attention from them, and he's done such a fabulous job of publicizing it and getting it into some really great places.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, just, I can't say enough good stuff about them. They're just fabulous.
It, I don't think writers talk about it much. I think we're scared to talk about it. Me, I seem to always be thinking about it, and it's that component of luck. You hit the right book at the right time. You know, the publicist manages to get it to somebody when they've had a good day.
Yes.
You know, it's the same thing with finding an agent or an editor. I mean, you know, you might have sent the manuscript to the perfect agent, but they got back from lunch. They were maybe gassy and were upset and angry and didn't look at your manuscript long enough.
I agree. And we all take it so personally. You know, we take all those rejections so personally.
It's hard not to. But you have to, and it's hard a lot of times to step back because, oh God, I mean, I was not quite so thorough in trying to find an agent. I was very pedantic about it. I would find two or three agents at a time, and I would, you know, well, what is this and what is this? And I'd try to, you know, divine something from, you know, what they had written on their profiles or something like this, you know, and, you know, I never was very big on the simultaneous submissions. And then I would get this rejection back, most of them form rejections, and I would revise the novel again.
Oh, yeah. That'll you know, take forever.
Not based on any notes or whatever, you know, so it took me, because I started mine while I was in graduate school. I'd shown up with a finished manuscript for another book that has gone into a drawer and is never going to come out ever. started this one and, you know, just was very careful because I knew it was going to be a difficult book because I didn't have a biography to sell it.
Right.
I was never a war journalist. I'm not an Asian woman.
Right.
You know? Right. I knew it was going to be tough. And so every time I would get even a form rejection, I would do something else. I would tweak it, do whatever. It took me 7 years.
Yeah.
And never found an agent. And I would get, you know, lovely little comments like, this has a haunting lyrical quality, but I don't know how to sell it. And I almost was like, why don't you try that haunting lyrical quality?
Yeah.
You know, one agent wanted me to turn it into like the Da Vinci Code in Bosnia.
Oh. No.
I was like, no, you know, but I had the third small press I sent it to. It was like, yeah, we like it. We'll take it.
Yeah.
And it was taken virtually as is. There was.
Oh, that's lucky.
I spent 7 years revising it every time I got a rejection letter.
Yeah.
And I don't want to do that again. That was dismal. How long usually does it take you to get a draft done? That a finished working draft that you then...
Well, that I'm ready to send out to agents?
Well, that you...
Or just the first draft?
Yeah, the first draft.
I would say 3 to 6 months.
Really?
But then, I mean, Point of Direction was written probably, I'll bet that's got 30 drafts
right, in it,
you know, full revisions. Yeah. So that's just the hashing out, that first draft, just the hashing out of the story. And they're usually real short. My first drafts are, I'm not someone who writes a ton and then cuts back, and somebody who writes a little and then adds and adds and adds. So overall, I think Point of Direction took about 6 years to write and revise.
Right.
Before it was ready to go.
Yeah, that's wow. Yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to ask a kind of a difficult question, how long did it take you to write it? Because everybody has a different measuring stick.
Right, and also it depends on how, you know, some people, it takes 2 years, but they got to write 10 hours a day, you know, and if you only have 2 hours a day to write, or, you know, 30 minutes a day or whatever, then, then it takes you much longer, you know, so it's more of how many hours did it take, really, but who knows how to count that, you know, but that's really more of a measuring stick, I think, than the years, because it depends on what else is going on in your life.
Yeah, you can usually squeeze a rough draft out of myself in a year.
Yeah.
And that's, you know... 2 hours on the weekdays and sometimes 3 or 4 on the weekends, you know, sandwiching in with chores and, you know, catching up on all the stuff I've been blowing off during the week.
Right.
And I write slowly, I guess. And tend to, I've gotten into the habit, and I don't particularly like it, of revising as I write.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I move so slowly, and some days it's easy to get thrown out of the dream that so that, you know, I end up, you know, waking up and just staring at the screen for the first 15 minutes going, I got nothing new. Back. Okay, I'll start there. That's wrong.
Right. But then you can end up revising forever stuff that you end up throwing out anyway.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. You have to be patient for the for those blank days, which Crazy. So are you an everyday morning type of thing, or just kind of?
Right now I am so off schedule. It's been a really, really busy time with all of the marketing. My publisher has done a fabulous job marketing my book.
Oh, yeah.
But he does all the New York stuff, and then I do, you know, all the rest of the grassroots stuff. So, you know, I'm constantly writing to book groups and libraries and women's adventure groups and to conferences to try to talk my way into those. And so I spend that time, that 2 to 3 hours marketing this book, which is significantly cutting into my writing time for my next one. Is starting to make me nervous that I'm gonna like forget how to do it, you know. Because I've taken a long break from writing to market this book, which stresses me out. But Susan, I had a conversation with Susan, my agent, about it, and she's just like, that's what you have to do. You know, now's the time to do all that stuff with this book. And, you know, that's what you should be doing, and just relax. You'll be fine. You write the next one. I'm pretty far into the next one, but I miss that practice. I miss the practice of
Of
working on it and being lost in that world. But the more I work on that one, the farther I feel from this one. And so it's harder to talk about this one, you know, but I've been going to a lot of book clubs. This is the scariest thing ever, because they almost know the book better than I do. every time I sit down, I'm just like, oh, now this is going to be the time when I get caught in some discrepancy. This happened and then this happened and it couldn't have happened because this happened, or whatever it is, you know, they just ask the most intricate, hard questions, you know, and it's, my mind is so in the next book that sometimes it's hard to answer.
Oh yeah.
Or sometimes it's a crafting thing, you know, sometimes the main reason that that thing happened or the character did that at that point was because I needed the next thing to happen
right.
for the plot point to come along, you know, and reading groups are totally not
they want to read a whole lot more meaning into that.
Yes, and but really, really it was
going,
like crafting.
I need to get to page two.
Yeah, and... like I got this next thing has to happen. And so he's got to go into the shed, you know, or whatever it is.
Right.
And so it's been an interesting, it's just been an interesting realization for me how different the crafting of a book is from the reading
right.
of a book. I mean, obviously that's an obvious thing, but in these book group discussions, it's been a real, it's just been fascinating to see
yeah.
that, you know, or, and also they ask very challenging questions and we have to really think, well, why did he do that? And why did she do that? And, you know, it's almost like they know the characters. They have such a more, they have a more intimate, close relationship with them because they've just read the book. You
right,
know? And,
right.
So it's interesting.
Well, if they're enthused about it, that's a good thing. They've,
oh, it's
they've
great.
Bonded with it.
Yeah, it's fabulous, I've, but I get scared.
Oh, be mysterious. Yeah. Going, yeah. Well, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I got that at the, you know, yeah. the end of the way my book ends is that they were, a lot of people were asking, well, do they stay together?
Yes. Like, I get that question too.
I don't, I eventually yeah. said, well, I have in my head what happens, but what do you think?
Yes.
Because I didn't want to yeah. tell them that.
Right, definitively.
You know, here I am putting this onto the podcast. It's going to go out in the world. I'm going to
yeah.
admit my my sin to it. It was that I have scenes that I wrote with those characters that were after I shaped the manuscript because
yeah.
I just couldn't drop these people. And those scenes are set years after the end of my action. And yes, my characters are split. They can't be around each other. There's
mm-hmm.
too much, you know, history or whatever for it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're, no, that doesn't work out.
Yeah.
The whole point of the book is, you know, this reunion. So you can't.
Right.
I can't. I just, you know, but it's 5 years old. Who cares?
Uh-huh.
That's impressive. I, how, yeah, you've got quite a book on your hands here, by the way.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, and I'm thrilled that you're getting all this recognition, you know, the ABA thing. That's cool.
Yeah, that was
I wish
really
they'd been
exciting.
Doing that when my book came out.
I know, I know. Yeah, that was really exciting. That was the first time I saw it as a book. It was just, the whole thing was so exciting because I had been, you know, chosen as one of their top 10 debut authors
right.
and flown to Seattle. It was the first time that I'd really been, you know, an author in a public way, you
right.
know, I mean, aside from just, you know, in my head. And I walked into the room and they had my book. It was the review copy, but it
right.
was the first time I'd seen it, you know, on a table with this big picture of myself and my book with 200 other authors all at their tables,
right.
you know, like famous people. And I was just totally blown away.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, the first person came up, the booksellers came up and she handed it to me and, or no, she came up and said, I would like a book. And, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, sure. And I handed it to her and the book distributor was standing next to me. She was like, you're supposed to sign it. And I was like, what? Why would they want a signed copy?
Because they're booksellers and they're cheesy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever work in a bookstore?
I didn't. I would have loved to.
Oh,
I still,
yeah.
I still think I would love to.
Well,
there's the coolest bookstore I've ever been in was just the other night, called the Book Bar in Denver. It's
oh, yeah?
run by this young woman. She's got young kids, and she opened this small bookstore, but it's a wine bar as well.
Oh wow!
And a coffee shop. She's got all these cozy couches and just the most fabulous books in
yeah.
there. Fabulous books, like just such an interesting collection because she doesn't have that much room, right?
Right.
And
right.
so my husband was actually asking her, you know, how do you choose? Because he was struck by the like the quality of the books that she
right.
had chosen, you know, and so he was like, how do you choose? She was like, I just choose what I like. And I thought, well, that's the kind of bookstore I would like to run.
That's one way to go, yeah.
yeah. Yeah. But, you know, she, I had a reading there and I felt a little bit bad because, you know, I invited all my friends who by this point have all bought my book, you know, and so she didn't sell that many books, but
right.
so I was like, oh, sorry, I know you didn't sell that many books. Most of the folks have already bought books, you know, and she was like, that's okay. She was like, your friends drink a lot of wine. I was like, well, good. What a great combination, right? A wine store and or a wine bar and a bookstore.
Oh yeah.
Great.
Yeah, most of the booksellers I know are winos.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. That's cool. I think you'll like Watermark when you get there.
No,
that
I can't
was the
wait.
The bookstore that I worked at, and you know, if well, every I think Sherman Alexie just started it where during the holiday season, writers can go in and spend a day helping hand sell books at their local independent bookstore. I did it this last Christmas. I think they're going to do it again next year.
Oh,
and you volunteer for it, and
oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's World Book Night.
Are you not allowed to hand sell your own?
Oh, I think you can.
Okay.
But you also, they also, I think they also work with the writer to get in some of the books that the writer likes.
Yeah. Oh, that's cool.
And then there's World Book Night, if you heard about this one. They do it every April. People, the organization provides a list of books that get specially printed and bound for World Book Night. You can pick a book off of their list, and then they ship, you know, copies of that book to you at your local independent bookstore, and that bookstore kind of sponsors it. And they go out and they give those books away free to underserved segments of the community.
Oh, cool.
And a friend of mine, another Unbridled author, Peter Guy, back there, his book, The Lighthouse Road, was in the last World Book Night this last April.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's a big, you know, kind of thing to get out there. So,
yeah.
And Watermark does that and all sorts of stuff out there. But,
oh, cool.
So yeah, I mean, if I think last year I didn't do the Sherman Alexie thing, I think because it's been so long since my book came out, what am I? No, just some schlub. If I can get another book out, I'm going to do it again.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to try and sign up and do it. But yeah, you learn a lot of interesting stuff about the industry working in an independent bookstore.
I'm sure.
Which has at times helped me out, but also I think been a bit of a crutch. Because, you know, I was not always the most socially adept person in the world. I once went on a slight rant about first-person semi-autobiographical buildings romans in front of a brand-new author that had written a book that was being sold as a first-person...
Uh-huh.
You know, and the rep, the books, the publisher's rep that I was ranting to about it has apparently loved to tell that story whenever I come up.
Uh-huh. Lovely.
Yeah. So what's the next one that you're working on?
It's another Alaskan adventure story.
Okay.
It is not a continuation of this one. It's different characters, different situation. It's the story of, single mom who commercially fishes with her young son.
Oh, cool.
And it's a bit controversial in that in Alaska, in real life, the fishing fleets from each community sort of work together. It's changed a bit now, but before cell phones and all of that, the fishing fleets would, you know, the Petersburg fleet versus the Juneau fleet, whatever, they would kind of work together and help each other out and sort of keep each other's backs, you know.
Right.
And so it's really the way the fishing fleet is affected by her somewhat controversial decision to take this baby out fishing with her. And she's kind of backed into a corner as to, you know, why she has to do that. And some of them support that decision and others think that she's just, you know, making this really stupid choice and endangering not only herself and her kid, but potentially others who would try to help her out. And so it's sort of the story of this woman who comes from a bad family situation and she sort of creates her own family out of this ragtag group of fishermen and some homesteaders who also get involved in the whole all sorts of things that happen to her as she's out on the fishing grounds with this baby.
Baby. Cool.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Yeah. It's been fun.
There's one last question. We'll wrap it up. This is kind of one that I always like to ask the guests. And, you know, every year or so we've get these new reports or there's the ritual hand wringing in the publishing industry that literary reading is on the decline. that were losing ground to TV and video games and to young adult books or, you know, or stuff or fan fiction. Mm-hmm. And people don't seem to be interested in reading. And I don't know what your experience was like in high school, but my experience, you know, when you're starting to get into books and when there's that potential to teach people about the, you know, the canon or the important works and what makes, you know, serious thought-provoking literature, they tend to beat the native intelligence out of kids because you've got 30 students in a class, you know, six times a day, and the teacher's got a textbook and she's, or he is just sitting there going, just get them to get this answer. And if kids don't agree with or whatever, they often get the impression that they aren't smart enough to get it. And so they stop reading, or they end up, if they end up continuing to read, they tend to read books that insult their intelligence, mm-hmm. Like Dan Brown, mm-hmm. which I have stories. Mm-hmm. We'll save them for later. And, you know, I've kind of, you know, having come from Naropa, both of us, mm-hmm. we've kind of attached ourselves to a lineage that's involved with being socially engaged, being mindful of the community and stuff like this. And there's a certain, I feel that writers, you know, like, you know, hunters and fishermen and stuff like this, we should be very concerned about the literary landscape and not isolate ourselves into an academic environment and just write for that environment or whatever. Right. But it's kind of hard to figure out what can we do to resuscitate, to grow, to tend to our literary ecosystem. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what kind of ideas you had for, you know, how do we get out there? How do we build that readership and ensure that we have a means to, you know, earn a living?
Oh, possibly that's a hard question. Yeah, you know? That's a hard question. I think my goal with this book and really with all my writing is to, well, I should back up and say that my dad was a big adventurer, you know, mm-hmm. a hunter and a fisherman and outdoorsman, and, you know, hitchhiked all over and had all these crazy stories about living on the beach in Mexico and doing whatever. So I grew up with him, this sense of adventure and how that's really life, you know, like right. life is this grand adventure. And he was a great storyteller, a big beer drinker, and he'd just get going at parties. And it was one of my favorite things just to listen to his stories. And my mom had tons of her own stories as well. And so I think I grew up around just like real solid adventure stories, right. Which kind of shaped my decisions when I, you know, was out of college and heading off in my own directions. I certainly had a lot of adventures of my own. But in my writing, I think my idea was always, you know, everybody likes a good story. Everybody really likes a good adventure story, especially. Mm-hmm. But I loved the lyricism and I loved the poetry of writing and all of that. So I wanted to somehow mesh the two so that even if you were just reading this, you know, adventure story about Alaska, you would, you know, sort of get like stuck, or not stuck, but it would like sneak in there, you right. know, the lyricism and the poetry, and maybe you'd notice a line or two that was well crafted or caught your attention or some metaphor or mm-hmm. whatever. But I didn't want that literary device to disrupt the story
right.
itself. And so I guess for me, that's sort of been my idea, is that if I, you know, like you can capture a bigger crowd, I think, with a real solid, good plot, like mm-hmm. you said, you know, that adventure, the good story aspect of things. But then you can also sort of expand someone's reading. You know, most people aren't going to pick up a book that's, you know, like lovely lyrical fiction.
Right.
Unless they're into that. But if you combine that mm-hmm. with something else, then you widen that reader's experience.
Right.
But in general, I think that everybody's always worried that not enough people read and that we're going to lose,
right.
you know, our base of people that are interested in books. But I think overall, everybody's interested in stories. Certainly a lot more people watch television than read books. But I think that there'll always be people who enjoy books. Mm-hmm. And sure, it's a smaller group, perhaps getting smaller, perhaps getting bigger here and there. But I think there's I mean, independent bookstores are still around, and bookstores are still around, and people are still buying books, and people are carrying their Kindle around everywhere they go, and, you know, people are still reading. So I think a lot of that hand-wringing is a little unnecessary.
I think in some ways it is. You know, it's I think the hand-wringing comes from a lot of people that are they're scared of the dirty masses.
Yes.
And it's like, no, those are the people I want reading, because they're the ones that have had, you know, their native intelligence squashed, and they think, oh, I'm not smart enough to get it. And so they prefer to watch TV when, you know, they'd be just as willing to read a book if someone would convince them they were smart enough to get it.
Right. Or even if you think about, like, the Harry Potter phenomenon, you know, not that I'm a huge fan of those books, but she got so many kids reading. You know, my cousins are of that age. They live around me now, and I was around them when all those books were coming out. And I mean, they were first in line at the Boulder Bookstore on the day that next one came out. You know, I mean, they were into it, and all their friends were into it. And so I think, you know, and again, she created a story that was that spoke to so many kids, and so she got this whole huge generation reading, and it almost seems like that opened up this whole new YA thing, because all those kids were like, well, what's next? I read now, you know, which is cool.
Yeah.
You know, it's really cool. And now there's this new sort of, like, I forget what it's called. It's like
new adult.
New adult. Yeah, I was going to say pre-adult. Yeah, but it's...
It drives me batty. Oh,
I know. I know, but it's like those kids are all... It's like that's... It's their... It's my cousin's generation, you know, where they're, you know, they're in their early 20s.
They have to be stepped into adulthood.
Yeah, but they're looking for, like, what's the next thing that I read? What it, you know, and so they are readers, and I think a lot of that is from Harry Potter, you know, and
but are they going to get stuck in that? I mean, are those kids get out of the new adult phase? We're going to have to create a new genre, say, for mid-adult?
Right.
I mean,
I don't know.
Just so that they...
I just start handing... I mean, now, you know, now my older cousin is in his early 20s, so I just hand him books every so often. Like, try this one, try that one. And he, you know, now he's...
Right.
But I think a lot of that is... I mean, he was always a good student and whatever, but he's, you know, a 23-year-old boy, and so he doesn't really read that much in general. But, you know, if I hand him a book, he's like, oh yeah, I read, you know, and he'll check it out and see what he thinks. And so I think there are readers. I mean, there's just, it's just a part of our society. Like, I don't think there'll ever be a point in time where everybody reads, you know, in the way that everybody watches television.
Right.
But there are readers everywhere you go. People love books, you know, people love stories. And
I'm just kind of disappointed that kids aren't, you know, illicitly discovering literature the way I did. You know,
well, it's different times.
You know, when you're when I was in high school and most people were having to have their arms twisted, you know, to read what was in the literature anthologies, or, you know, because there was not really a YA category. You know, I was that kid that made everybody's jaw drop because I liked dragging the satanic verses with me to class. You know, you know,
See, I wasn't that kid. I really didn't enjoy that, the canon that we were forced to read. I really didn't. And I, you know, and I thought of myself as a scientist for sure, much more so than, or like a science, you know, a kid that was more bent towards the sciences than writing back then for sure. But I enjoyed reading for pleasure. I enjoyed, you know, all the books that I would read on the side that my mom would be like, here, read this one, or here, read that one. Or, you know, my friends would hand me some like trashy, like bumpy book, you know, like the bumpy cover. And my mom would be like, what are you reading? But I would like it, you know? And so I think I always just enjoyed reading whatever I wanted to read. I didn't want to read all of the classics. And I still, I mean, even when I got to Naropa, you know, I was there with a bunch of people that had undergraduate degrees in English, and they had just read that canon that I hadn't, you know, and so I'd have to like make sure I didn't make an idiot out of myself because I hadn't read a lot of those books, or catch up. I did a lot of catching up. I did a lot
I'm still doing a lot of catching up.
Reading, reading of all of that, those books that I was supposed to read in high school,
right?
Or would have read as an English major in college, but yeah.
Yeah, as long as we can just not destroy people's curiosity to read.
Yes.
Whether they actually choose to read or not, we can't do anything about. But just that point where we don't have them, you know, I just want to find a spot where they aren't either, you know, thinking I'm too dumb to get it or willing right. to tolerate having their intelligence insulted by people like Dan Brown.
Right.
You know.
Right. Well, and that's a good bookseller, yeah. right? Like somebody who walks in to a bookstore and says, well, I don't really know what I want to read, but I want something good. And then right. that's a good bookseller who can kind of be like, okay, what are you into? What was the last book that you read that you like? And
yep.
sort of try to figure out yeah. All those things. I love those. I don't even know what they are, but my local library has one, and I'm sure there's something on the computer where you can, you know, type in like a book that you liked, and mm-hmm. then it will suggest others right. that you might like. And the one at our local library is dead on. I mean, I can put in a book that I like, and it'll list, you know, like five others that uh-huh. I've read and I have absolutely loved, like that match well.
Right.
I just think something like that, like the more of those types of ways that we can use technology and, you know, because there must be like a room full of people that are so good at that, you know,
yeah.
like, okay, if somebody liked this book, then they're going to like these other 10 or these other five or whatever.
Kind of the and Pandora so, approach, looking
yeah.
at the genetics of it.
But
yeah.
that would be really hard to do, right? But that's a good, like, what a good tool for booksellers.
It would be a great job creator for English majors, and
yes.
we need that.
I know, right? I've been trying to figure out how to get that job. But I'd only be good in like this one category, right? Because I really don't read wide enough. But I could do that one category
right.
really well. But yeah, I think, yeah, so I think just, you know, helping people navigate and find books that they might like. But I find now, even just with my book out and being more, you know, seen as an author, even people just in my normal everyday life will have been asking me for book recommendations, you know, mm-hmm. people that don't really read and don't really know.
Right.
And they'll say, well, what do you think I might like? Or can you suggest a book or whatever? So I don't know. I think people are interested. I think most people
you can get them.
Like
you
to just, read. Yeah, you can snag them.
Some of them you just need to kind of handhold to make
yeah.
sure they don't give up.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you, Rachel.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for stopping by.
Yeah.
All right. There you have it. My conversation with Rachel Weaver. Be sure to come back in 2 weeks. I'm not sure who will be on or what we'll be doing, but we will have another episode in 2 weeks. Have a happy 4th of July.